Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
The essence of America, what really unites us, it is an idea. That you can come from humble circumstances and you can do great things.
This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We are the free and unconquerable people of the United States of America.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear.
The story of America is one of people who have made their dreams come true by realizing that the time for action is always now.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. This hour, the next exploration in our series on what it means to be an American. I'm spending some time this month with musicians, theologians, writers, and activists on the question of American identity. What does it mean to live in and love America? Do we still share the same democratic ethic and ideals? What does the we and we the people mean today? I'm opening each of these conversations with a quotation from Langston Hughes' powerful poem, Let America Be America Again. He writes in the second stanza, "Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed." Claudia Rankine is with me. She's an award-winning poet, and her book, Citizen, was a finalist for the National Book Award and winner of the Penn Open Book Award. And I asked her if she would consider those words about the dream.
Let America be the dream. The dream is dream. That is a nostalgic line, I think, that that assumes something was in place that perhaps never was in place. And it makes me think of Thomas Jefferson and the way he always felt that given the way white Americans treated blacks, that our relations would always be contentious. So I'm not quite sure which America Langston Hughes was referring back to, because the strifes were there initially and they continue to be there now.
There's so much grieving in that poem. And I read it as, I guess what you're saying, that the American ideal has never been achieved. Here's my question about that. Do you think there was a time when we the people shared a more collective ideal? And I ask that in the midst of, you know, a very polarized time in the country.
Well, I think the American ideal has never included Native Americans, never included African Americans. So the fact that it continues to be a strife makes apparent an omission that was always there. Even if you look back on the rhetoric and say, no, the rhetoric is meant for all citizens, apparently the definition of citizen for many white Americans ended with a reflection of themselves. And we have had a constant history of the tolerance by American citizens for black death, you know, be it slavery or lynchings or incarceration or shooting by police. There has not been a time that the appetite for black death was not part of the American experience.
When you say that you don't think the American ideal has ever included Native Americans, African Americans, do you mean that from a historical sense, or do you mean that in a contemporary sense as well?
I think historically. I think initially it didn't even include Irish or, you know, Polish people, Jews. The original conception of free whites meant free Anglo-Saxon white men. That's who was being referred to. That's who was considered capable of self-governance. And we're at a period now where 90% of elected offices are held by whites and 75% of those are held by white men. So things have not changed that radically.
I want you to listen to a bit of a speech that President Obama gave in Selma. I've pulled different excerpts from this for these conversations. And this one, I think, really speaks to how we've begun this discussion. He's reflecting on what this idea of America is. Let's listen.
America's not the project of any one person. Because the single most powerful word in our democracy is the word we. We the people. We shall overcome. Yes, we can. That word is owned by no one. It belongs to everyone. Oh, what a glorious task we are given.
Okay, so given what you just said about the ideal and where we are today, how do you hear what the president is saying there?
I think that he's right in an aspirational sense, but given that racism is structural, the limits of that we was all, you know, always in place. It was in place in terms of the justice system, in place in terms of schooling, in place in terms of who gets incarcerated, and it has stayed in place. So it's not an individual proclivity. It's not even located in the tendencies of a single candidate. We're talking about a structural failure inside our democracy that has to be addressed.
You know, that's an urgent problem, what you've just said, because I would say that democracy really demands some kind of shared ideal, some kind of solidarity to work, doesn't it?
It demands a solidarity. And what is striking and I think often overlooked is that the solidarity has been in service of exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And because it is not accidental that we have gone centuries and been in a position where African Americans have been treated in the way that they have been treated. So that just says to me that it's systemic and somehow a tolerable reality inside Americans' notion of democracy.
I want to pull that out a little more, what you said about the idea of solidarity relying upon exclusion. You know, right now, where we are in this presidential campaign, I think we're really seeing the confrontation of that idea play out, right, in real time.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things that if there's an upside to this presidential campaign, it's that it has laid bare the realities that have been consistently under the surface and utilized by certain parties over the years.
How do you persuade what's a long time held, and I don't even know if people would, you know, if you presented it to them as, do you realize that the solidarity of our democracy has long relied on exclusion? I think people would not want to believe that of themselves and of the country. But how do you persuade Americans that that is true and that must change?
Well, I think if we would keep present the consistent line of treatment of non-whites in this country and understand that it is not accidental and that things don't continue unless they are maintained, then I think people would begin to understand that they have been in collusion with the exclusion. So I think, you know, in many ways, I think one the upside of our present times is that people are finally seeing that these things are systemic and not tied to any single individual.
I think what you said about it not being accidental is important because that suggests accountability, doesn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, you know, I'm one of the things that's been striking to me is sometimes I'm listening to police after they've shot unarmed black people. And, you know, they're asked, why did you shoot me or why did you shoot him? And they say, I don't know. And I the first time I heard a police say this in one of those videos, it struck me that they were telling the truth, that the ways in which the structures of the culture had married blackness to criminality and had made toxic the white imagination when it was actually viewing the black person. And then when they moved to actually kill the black person, for them, that fear is a real fear. They really do believe this. I mean, I'm sure some of them are, you know, white supremacists and have another agenda. But for, I think for people, they're doing their job and they are shocked that they're moved to do something illegal because a fear has appeared that has nothing to do with the reality in front of them. And so the entire culture has to look at the fact that they have put that fear there and created these false analogies between blackness and criminality and then have moved to act upon them. And that has gone on from the very beginning. You start by saying blacks are not people, and then you systematically over the centuries move to remove them.
I think what you've said speaks to a short paragraph that you write in Citizen where you say, because white men can't police their imagination, black people are dying.
Well, I do think that it comes down to the imagination in the end, because we act upon that which we conceive. And often, you know, people have this idea that we live with the ability to be objective, but we don't. We are incredibly subjective and we're walking around with all kinds of prejudice in our heads, and those things are motivating what we do. And if you have a culture that is in collusion with the devaluing of black people, then the imagination is going to, you know, support the killing of black people, which is what we've seen. We, you know, when Darren Wilson killed Michael Brown, he said, what I saw was a demon. Mm-hmm. What I saw was the Incredible Hulk. And I do not believe that he was making that up.
The challenge here is because you, when you explained that line, those sentences from Citizen, because white men can't police their imagination, black people are dying, you started deep back in American history. The challenge is that, and I know you've heard this, white Americans saying, I can't be accountable and responsible for what happened a century ago. I can't even be responsible for what happened 50 years ago. I'm where I am today, and I have good intentions. Is that sufficient?
Well, I think that if the good intentions mean that you're out on the street outraged that Tamir Rice has been killed, that Michael Brown has been killed, that Philando Castile has been killed, it means that you understand that there is something very toxic and rotten in the system and that the democracy must change. If you're not out in the streets doing that, then you're part of the collusion of the culture to continue to kill black people. And that's not about 1776. That's about 2016.
Y'all haters corny with that Illuminati mess. Paparazzi, catch my fly and my cocky fresh. I'm so reckless when I rock my Givenchy dress. I'm so possessive, so I rock his rock necklaces. My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama. Sauce in my bag, swag. I see it.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the latest conversation in our series on what it means to be an American, having a discussion with poet Claudia Rankine. She's an award-winning poet, and her book Citizen was a finalist for the National Book Award. I asked if she would read an excerpt from Citizen that really speaks to what we're talking about today.
A friend argues that Americans battle between the historical self and the self-self. By this she means you mostly interact as friends with mutual interest and, for the most part, compatible personalities. However, sometimes your historical selves, her white self and your black self, or your white self and her black self, arrive with the full force of your American positioning. Then you are standing face to face in seconds that wipe the affable smiles right from your mouths. What did you say? Instantaneously, your attachment seems fragile, tenuous, subject to any transgression of your historical self. And though your joined personal histories are supposed to save you from misunderstandings, they usually cause you to understand all too well what is meant.
One of the other things that I've wondered about is whether we're in a time where we have polarized perceptions of what social justice actually is. Maybe it's always been like this. It feels different.
Well, I think we're in one of the most exciting times around social justice. I think movements like Black Lives Matter, the way in which social media has energized the population, Suddenly, individual experiences are valued and motivating and informing mainstream media. So I think that that's one of the good things about now, that we are able to circulate the videos of the shooting so people don't have to take it on anybody's word. It doesn't have to be hearsay. You can actually see what is happening. Mm. There is no longer the illusion that these are the things that happen in the South versus, the East Coast or the West Coast. We see that it is happening across the country, in the Midwest. All of those things that people used to argue when you brought it up and said, no, this is going on, there's no longer this sense like, well, you don't know. It's like, yes, we all know. We are seeing it. And we have the videos as evidence and proof available to us whenever we want them. So I think that's a good thing. And people are speaking out. I think when Philando Castile's was killed in the car, his partner said, Facebook, pray for me. And so that sense that she was in community with the rest of us, and that suddenly she could speak to us and that we as American citizens would hear her, whether or not the justice system was broken and would not work for her, she still felt like she was part of a community. And I think that is an amazing moment to be in.
You've reminded me of something that I've been raising during these conversations about what it means to be an American, which is geography. I wonder how you think the geography of the American landscape shapes the way we think about what it means to be an American, and if that is more pronounced today than it's been.
Well, I think it's less. I mean, I think that in the past, you felt safer, say, on the East Coast or the West Coast because you felt like those populations were in some ways more tolerant than, say, the Midwest or the South. But now we're seeing that the problems are everywhere. And so I think, even with the red state, blue state stuff, there is still a sense that all Americans have at their ready the ability to either be inclusion or not, and that the problems are systemic and across the country. So I don't think we are so regional anymore because of social media. Some Black Lives Matter could start out in Oakland or in San Francisco, but then it moved across the country, had its own branches in various cities, from St. Louis to Baltimore, Dallas, you know? So I think in many ways I would think that this sense of regional amnesia is going away and that we are moving more and more towards a collective movement on both ends, as we have seen during this election, that there is also a kind of radical movement in the direction of white supremacist reinstatement.
You know, what's interesting, though, to hear you describe the instantaneous collectivism that we can enjoy through social media. I mean, even so, it still feels, I guess, in this hyperpolarization, that it's that we can retreat into our misinformed and echo chambered kind of places as easily as we ever did.
I mean, that might be true for certain individuals, but I think I can only speak for myself, and you know, I feel like I am much more in solidarity with Minnesotans over, you know, specific events that are happening there, or people in Baltimore, or people in St. Louis. I feel like I suddenly know the names of the murdered victims. I know the names of the police. I know the streets that people were killed on. And so I, you know, for myself, I know that I feel a kind of solidarity and recognition as an American citizen. I feel that, you know, for many people, this election feels important because suddenly there is a tangible recognition of the crisis that we're in.
You use the word citizen, and of course, that's the name of your book, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Has the idea of what it means to be a citizen, I mean, is that still forming for you? Has the idea of it changed for you since you titled your book with that?
No. I mean, I think that the book was a way of investigating what it means to hold the position of being an American citizen and yet not be able to have the mobility of that position in your day-to-day life.
Well, tell me what that means.
Well, I think that for white Americans, there is the ability to move around this country with freedom, with a sense that you own the space. For African Americans, I have a passport. I am a citizen, and yet you know that you could be killed for just walking in the street or playing with a toy gun, or you're at the mercy at someone else's imagination or constructed fears, and that you or your brother or your, you know, sister could be pulled over and before you know it, dead. And I could be wrong, but I don't think white Americans move through the landscape with that same tenuous precarity, that same sense of it could be over. You know, I was in a car. I had a driver driving me in Virginia to D.C. And, you know, he was driving at the speed limit. We were talking, and suddenly a police car pulled us over. And the policeman came to the car, and he started shouting at the black driver. And he didn't see me in the back seat. And I took out my phone to record this. And once he saw me and the phone, he just turned around and walked away.
Wow.
So there was no, you know, what happened to, I need, get out of the car, I need your license. All of that just went away. So that's what I mean. I mean, you know, it could have gone any way in that moment. And obviously the driver was not armed. And we, you know, he said to me, I better pull over. And I said, why? You're not doing anything wrong. And he said, yeah, but he's shadowing me.
You're listening to the latest exploration on the series of what it means to be an American. I'm talking with theologians and musicians, poets and writers on the question of American identity. And I'm having a conversation this hour with poet Claudia Rankin. She's an award-winning writer, and her book, Citizen, was a finalist for the National Book Award. One of the other things that comes to mind here is the mythology around America, and since we've been talking about what it means to be a citizen, the mythology around citizenship, and I don't mean that in the sense of I have my documentation, that kind of way, but the idea that we apply to what it means to be a citizen of the country, what comes to mind when I ask you about that?
Well, it's funny that you say I don't mean documentation, but clearly for Obama, it didn't mean President Obama didn't
yeah,
mean documentation.
Right.
And that's exactly the thing. I mean, you know, for African Americans, it means a lack of acceptance at every level. You know, you could be taking the oath of office to become the first black president and somebody's asking for documentation still. And so and I think in more subtle ways, we see that as African Americans in our lives. You are entering a building and people are let in, but then you have to produce ID suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
People come up to you. Can we help you? In spaces where other people can walk freely.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're constantly being asked to reassert, reaffirm, you know, make other people comfortable about your presence in their conceived space, you know?
And does that still happen to you?
Yeah. No, I think it happens to African Americans all the time, every day. It's just part of the way in which we move through the world.
One of the things that the president said in that address in Selma was that we're too easily taken in, seduced by this idea of amber waves of grain and purple mountains majesty. You know, that's part of what I think of as the mythology mm-hmm. about America. But what that really does is obscure the necessity to do the hard work of examining mm-hmm. our identity. Is some of that happening now?
I think so. I think for the first time, I'm teaching a class at Yale this semester called White Constructions of Whiteness. And the students are, you know, sometimes surprised at how deep the lack of acceptance goes. And
okay, such as what?
For example, after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, there were blacks in the Senate. And that was so outrageous to whites that that moment was the formation of the KKK.
I didn't know that.
And you know, and then that was stopped immediately. So, you know, there are moments where the democracy tried to be the we of the we, you know, of the we, the people. And it was shut down. And then the second wave of the KKK was in the Midwest. It was, you know, across the Midwest. And then it really, whites really turned the full force of their power against African Americans starting in the 1940s with the Civil Rights Movement. It's systemic. It's not a long time ago. People like to think, I'm a good person. Why do you keep bringing up this unpleasant stuff?
Yeah.
And it's not about individuals. It's not about, it's about a system, a democracy that has systemically and continuously failed in this very area. I mean, it started with genocide with American Indians and slavery with blacks, and that was the beginning, and it has in different ways maintained that throughout time. So it's not a historical long ago positioning. It's a positioning that affects everything to this day in terms of who gets incarcerated, what funding goes to schools, redlining. Segregation forever was, I'm afraid, the foundation on which this country was built.
Do you think the eagerness with which those declarations after the inauguration in 2009 of President Obama to declare we are now post-racial, that we're in a time of post-racialness, goes to exactly what you've just said, this sense that we've changed, we're different, why do you keep bringing up these mm-hmm. uncomfortable topics? Is that what that was about?
Well, it was about aspirational thinking. You know, I want this to be the case, not a red state, not a blue state, these United States of America. I mean, we all went to the polls with that ringing in our heads, but it doesn't change the imagination. It doesn't change the structure. It doesn't change how the justice system works until it's changed. And apparently it's not. And that's, you know, that's what we began to see. And that has happened alongside white people feeling aggrieved about their own positionality. So it's, you know, it's a interesting time that we're in. When you have the realities of a system that is structured on racism, and then you have a party that feels that whiteness is under attack, you know, you realize that you have people with very, very different narratives about what's going on.
I think what you've said there is important to discuss a little more about the aggrieved side of that equation. It isn't just that as change came, it was going to make a part of our American democracy uncomfortable. It was that the reaction to that was a sense of grievance, which I have to say, I think that's what Donald Trump has built his campaign completely on, right? The sense of
Definitely.
A grievance to be expressed and set right.
Exactly. I think, you know, people think that the fact that President Obama was elected meant that things had changed. And that's why it's, I think, important that we don't think about these things in terms of individuals. We think about it in terms of what is the system doing? What does that look like? And it was historic and important that he became our president, and we were very lucky, you know, for 8 years to have him as our president. But it didn't change the way in which the police system regarded Black people. It didn't change the way in which communities were educated. It didn't change the ways in which individuals were targeted and profiled and imprisoned, and the numbers around that. And so those things are about what holds on in the system, despite our good intentions, our individual good intentions.
I'd like to ask you about where you think American exceptionalism fits into the way we think about what it means to be an American.
What do you mean by that exactly?
I think that goes to some of the mythology that there is something so extraordinary, so special about who we are as Americans in the rest of the world that it informs and maybe gets in the way of a clear-eyed look at our identity. That's just my view. I'm interested in what you think.
Well, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that is incredible about this country is that everybody's here, right? And this country, this great country, was formed on immigration. And in the beginning, a lot of the strife was not directed at African Americans. It was directed at other whites who weren't considered whites. You know, that when they were coming in, they were being called Black or brown people, Italians, Irish. So that sense that we were trying, or that certain Americans were trying to hold on and keep whiteness as a pure thing, mm-hmm. initially meant that the Irish were treated very badly, the Italians were treated very badly. But nonetheless, everybody was coming, and they were able to sort of integrate into the society. And eventually, all of these immigrants become just white people. And they, as communities, ethnicities, they forget about that and become this like one group trying to keep everybody else away. And yet people keep coming. And it's, you know, that I think is pretty remarkable that despite the attempts to shut down the we the people, it is constantly expanding to include Arab Americans, include all kinds of people. And the fight has always been to allow people to come in, to have the life that everyone aspires to. And we managed to do that. And apparently we managed to do it better than many European countries, as we see the strife that has moved across Europe in terms of immigration in the last few years. So for me, that is why we maintain the reputation of being an exceptional country, because people do come. And the nagging thing is why, when others are able to assimilate into this culture, the racism against African American continues. And it to me, it must just be a visual thing. As long as you can look and label somebody as not white, then all of the anger and fear and disregard can be targeted towards one part of the population as everybody else manages to assimilate through generations. And then, you know, nobody now thinks, oh, that Irish person, they're not a white person. That Italian person, they're not a white person, when that was the state initially. It's a curious thing.
If I asked you for some descriptive adjectives, writer that you are, for We the People, what would come to mind about what this we the people is today?
It's both a collective. It's a collective division. It's, you know, we're all here. We're all here, and yet the segregation is astounding. We're sharing public transportation. We're shopping in the same places. And we're managing never to sit at each other's tables, to share spaces. It's an amazing collective division.
Is there a writer, a poet or fiction writer or nonfiction writer, that you think really speaks to the question that you and I are considering in this discussion?
Well, there are many writers right now. Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercy is an incredible book, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, Marilynne Robinson, what she writes about when she talks about loneliness inside of this culture is astounding to me. There are poets, Langston Hughes, James Baldwin was writing about everything now and then. Ralph Ellison, Toni Morrison has probably put a sentence to every thought that we're having. There's so many great American writers, songwriters, Bob Dylan, looking at this the same dynamic we're discussing. Beyonce's Lemonade, Ava DuVernay's 13th Amendment. You know, it's just, I think we're all trying to figure it out. Why is this so difficult for white Americans to see this we as a collective we? Why is it so hard to see another human being as another human being?
Bob Dylan is a new Nobel laureate for literature. What do you think of that?
I think it's fantastic. I love Bob Dylan. I've sang his songs. The thing about musicians, they are able to put in a refrain things that other writers could spend years trying to say in a few sentences. And Bob Dylan is one of those people where you find yourself singing his songs, or a moment will come up and a refrain will come to you that encapsulates that moment. And he has been sort of editorializing American history his entire life, which has been my entire life, actually. His songs were sang at voter registration rallies, at the March on Washington. The guy's been around, and his work has been shared by everyone, I think, across racial lines in this culture. So I think he's more than deserving of this honor.
We're going to close with a Dylan song. Which one should we close with, and what would you say, what could you say about why you're going to choose whatever you'll choose?
Only a pawn in the game, because he's only a pawn. You know, they're only a pawn in the game. That one, you remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
That's the one I'll choose.
And why?
Partly because that's the one that he performed at voter registration rallies, and I think if ever there was an election that we all need to feel that our presence is needed. An election where we have to show up at the polls, it's this one, because we don't want to be in a situation where we're asking for a do-over, because we're not going to get it. And so if we care about our children, if we care about the Supreme Court, if we care about our ability to hold dear this democracy, will show up and vote. And Dylan sang that song to get people to go to the polls. So I'm invoking it here.
Claudia, thank you so much. Thank you for this.
Oh, you're welcome.
The deputy sheriffs, the soldiers, the governors get paid. And the marshals and cops get the same. But the poor white man's used in the hands of them all like a tool. He's taught in his school from the start by the rule that the laws are with him to protect his white skin, to keep up his hate, so he never thinks straight about the shape that he's in. But it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. From the poverty shacks, he looks from the cracks to the tracks. And the hoofbeats pound in his brain. And he's taught how to walk in a pack, shoot in the back with his fist in a clinch. To hang and to lynch, to hide neath the hood, to kill with no pain, like a dog on a chain. He ain't got no name, but it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. Today Medgar Evers was buried from the bullet he caught. They're lowering him down as a king. But when the shadowy sun sets on the one that fired the gun, he'll see by his grave, on the stone that remains, carved next to his name, his epitaph plain, only a pawn.